Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Strange Dominions. I am your host, Octavian Graves. Tonight, I have the pleasure of speaking with Soraya Azcath, who runs Where Did the Road Go? Podcast and Last Exit for the Lost radio show. We speak on almost every area of the paranormal we could think of, from UFOs, ghosts, Bigfoot, consciousness, Kundalini, and even some of Soraya's personal accounts. All of Soraya's information will be in the show notes below. We have a Patreon up, and there is one episode on there so far. There will be trying to do one, hopefully two monthly shows on Patreon, but there are four tiers, and each have their own specific merchandise, and the lowest grade is $4 a month, so if you would like to support the show and get extra content, that is the best way for you to do so. If you have seen something strange, unusual, paranormal, supernatural, such as Bigfoot, ghosts, UFOs, Dogman, and everything in between, send us an email at strangedominionspodcast@gmail.com. That is strangedominionspodcast@gmail.com. And with that, let's get into the interview. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I am here with Soraya Azcath, host of Where Did the Road Go? Podcast. So how are you doing, Soraya?
Hey, I'm doing all right.
Awesome. I'm really excited to have you on because I've been a fan for probably the last like 3 or 4 years when I found you. And I've just always really enjoyed the way that you do your podcast and the kind of setup that you have. But so where did that start? Like, where did you get into the paranormal? How did that really begin for you?
Oh boy.
You can be as general or as specific as you want.
I was always interested in the stuff growing up, like the unexplained, lost civilizations, the Bermuda Triangle, all that stuff. But I mean, it was, you know, as a kid, you only got exposed to so much stuff. Like, I'd watch TV specials on it and stuff like that. And it was just kind of a background interest. Like, you know, I saw Indiana Jones and I wanted to be an archaeologist to find Atlantis. And things like that, or I wanted to be an astronomer so I could look for UFOs, which apparently Valet made that same mistake. Only to find out that that's not what they do. And I was kind of like, oh, well, then never mind. But the unexplained stuff has always kind of been a draw for me. And so that was always kind of in the background. I had a Kundalini awakening when around the time I hit puberty, which then started me having just weird experiences, but I didn't connect them to anything paranormal. I just thought there was something wrong with me. And slowly I got more interested in stuff, you know, because more interesting books came out, like Communion and stuff like that. UFOs was always a thing I was really interested in. Got into Valet stuff, into Kiel stuff, found Fate magazine. And so that's kind of what nurtured that interest in the paranormal and stuff. And I had friends who were into like Wicca and stuff. And so that kind of took me down the occult path as well. And then being introduced to people like Aleister Crowley, you know, that's kind of where all that came from. And eventually I started realizing that when I started practicing magic and looking at the experiences I was having, I was going, huh, these aren't completely different from some of the stuff that's happening to Strieber. Except I'm not getting UFOs.
Yeah.
And so very early on,
Well, I was just going to say that you like that idea of magic and the paranormal having a lot of parallels. I really want to hit on that later, but keep going. I'm sorry.
Yeah. And I didn't hear anyone talking about that stuff when I made that realization. I'm sure somebody was. But I didn't, I hadn't come across it at that point. So it was just a slow process of getting more and more into that stuff. I never had any interest in doing a podcast. I didn't particularly like talk radio or anything like that. My dad used to listen to Rush Limbaugh used to drive me nuts.
Yeah, I had one of my ex-girlfriend's parents. That's all they listened to, that and anything Glenn Beck. I couldn't take it.
Well, this was more in the 90s.
Yeah.
So it's mostly him just attacking Clinton nonstop. And it's like my dad just listened to it constantly. Like that's all he had on, and I was just like, oh my god, I hate talk radio.
Yeah.
And I found Graham Hancock sort of randomly, and there was a special on Discovery Channel, or say it's a 3-part special that Graham did with Discovery or History or one of those cable stations. And I would leave the TV on when I was doing other stuff and just throw it on one of those stations because nice stuff to look at, you know? And I would always have my closed captioning on because I like to see it in case I miss something someone says, I can see it. So I have the sound off, closed captioning on, and I look over and I'm like, oh, cool, pyramids. And I'm doing stuff. And then it says something about the pyramids being aligned to Orion. And I went, wait, what? Hang on. And I just got the end of the second part. And I was like, what is this? Who is this guy? And the third part came on and I took down his info. And I'm like, Graham Hancock, I got to see if I can find anything from him. And I went to an occult bookstore and all they had was Heaven's Mirror.
Okay.
I had no idea Graham was like a best-selling author at this point. I probably could have picked up something else at a normal bookstore, but I wasn't thinking of going to a normal bookstore. And so I read Heaven's Mirror, and that has his wife's photography in it too, which is amazing. And I was just like, I really like this guy. And so I started digging into more of his stuff. And finally, he posted, like, I don't know if it was a torrent or a download or something, of all his appearances at that point up on Coast to Coast. And I went, oh. Or no, actually, I think he said he was going to be on Coast to Coast. And I said, I don't like talk radio, but I kind of want to hear Graham Hancock talk about this stuff. So I figured out whatever station I could get in to get Coast to Coast. And I'm like, I probably won't be able to deal with listening to the whole thing, but I want to check it out. And then I listened to the whole show. And it was like, okay, that was cool. I really like listening to Graham Hancock. So then he put up a post, whatever it was, MySpace at the time. I have no idea. It's been too long. With just like a bunch of his Coast to Coast interviews. So I downloaded that and kind of savored it. If I took long trips, I'd listen to like one of those. And I was like, wow, I really love this. And then I'm like, who else is on Coast to Coast? And so I started looking that up and finding they had, you know, Robert Schock and all these other people I was interested in on there. And so then I was like, wait, are there other shows like this? And I started finding other podcasts. And at the time, podcasts weren't a huge thing. But, so then that's how I got into listening to podcasts initially, was because of Graham. And I found a few I liked and a few I was kind of like so-so on, but would have good guests on that I liked. And so at some point, one of those so-so ones had Jesse Ventura on. And being a big wrestling fan, I was like, oh, cool, Jesse Ventura. And I kind of like Jesse Ventura's politics. So I'm like, I'll listen to this. And the person doing the interview wasn't even paying attention to what Jesse was saying.
They never do. Whenever he's on any kind of like show, they always like gloss over any topic he brings up, anything like that.
Well, he was basically, and the thing he was saying was just that we need a third and fourth party in this country, politically. And the host goes, well, that idea scares me. And he goes, what do you mean that scares you? What scares you about that? And they couldn't answer because they clearly weren't listening to him. And I'm like, why does this person get to talk to Jesse Ventura and I don't?
Right.
And so I said, okay. Well, and I was already doing The Last Exit for the Lost, which is my music show.
Right.
And that's on a commercial FM station. Huh?
That's just, I love that radio. It's like when I didn't even know that you did it, and I had found it before I'd ever like talked to you or anything like that. And I used to listen to that going to work all the time.
Nice. Awesome. So I had like a connection. I wasn't thinking podcast when I started Where Did the Road Go? I was thinking radio, more like Coast to Coast. And I was like, well, I wonder if they'd let me do a talk thing because it is more of a music station. And I did a couple sample runs with like some local ghost hunters and another friend of mine. And we did a couple of shows in Last Exit that talked about, you know, weird stuff. And I was like, and people the audience was like, yeah, this is awesome. You should totally do a show like this. And I was like, okay. And I asked the station and they didn't respond to me. And I'm like, well, I guess that's a no. And I was talking to one of the other DJs and he goes, oh no, they never answer. Hit him up until he answers you. And so I wrote the guy again, the program director. And he's like, oh no, I thought this was a great idea. I'm sorry. I totally forgot to answer you. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. And so I started it in January of 2013, January 26th, actually, of 2013 was the first show. And until the week of the show, I didn't actually know what I was going to do. And I had heard on Coast to Coast, Jim Elvich talking about his Universe Solved book. And even though my goal is usually to read the books of the people who come on, but there really wasn't time to do that by the time I got a hold of Jim Elvich. And I said, look, I heard you on the show. I haven't read the book, but I'd love to have you on, especially since he went to school in Cornell and the radio station is right on the edge of Cornell. And so he was like, yes, I'll do that. Absolutely. I'll be your first guest. That would be awesome. And so I had him on and it just kind of took up from there. And I think the fact that I was on FM radio too also helped get bigger name guests right away.
Yeah, I can definitely understand what that.
You know, so like when, you know, I wrote people like Robert Schock going, he's not going to come on. He's like, I'd love to come on. I'm like, really? Awesome. All right. So, and that helped push the show ahead right away. I mean, I think the second person I had on was David Weatherly talking about the Black Eyed Kids.
And I just listened to that episode today because I was going back through like the archives and trying to find like the earliest episode I could. And I was listening to that today. And boy, like I knew about the Black Eyed Kids. It's not a phenomenon that I did a lot of research on or found a lot of references for, but after listening to your interview with David, I started looking into it, and there's a lot more parallels with the Black Eyed Kids and certain occult currents and phenomena that I never really hear talk about. Yeah, yeah, the Men in Black, absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, I asked him and he was, and like I said, I think part of it is it was a legitimate radio station. It wasn't just a podcast because in 2013, podcasts had not quite broken like they are now where everyone has a podcast, you know?
Right. I think Joe Rogan, he started in 2009, but he didn't really pick up a lot of steam until like 2015, 2016.
Yeah. Yeah. And so like, having that radio station behind me, I think helped a lot. And I was just like, well, and I'll throw it up as a podcast and I'll throw it on YouTube and hey, maybe a few people will listen to it. I didn't expect anyone to like what I was doing, honestly, because I was trying to stay away from I can never remember this word when I need it.
I have the same problem with a lot of words.
The sort of overblown sensational. I always know it's an S word and I can never remember what it is. I wanted to stay away from the sensationalistic type of stuff. Okay. I wanted to get down to sort of like the what is actually going on here type of stuff.
Right.
And so,
I was just agreeing with you that's a good angle to go with.
And I figured, you know, people are going to hate this because people don't care. They just want the scary stories. And I want to know what's going on. You know, I want to actually investigate this stuff. I want to talk to people and ask, maybe ask them questions I haven't heard them ask before. And, Weatherly, I think on YouTube, within a couple of days had jumped to like 3,000 hits. And I was like, whoa, okay. I didn't expect that. I have no idea what it's at now, probably like 100 or 200,000 or something like that. But like that just, and then people started subscribing to the show. And then I had people like Robert Schock and Andrew Collins on, and that pumped it up even more. So I think I hit just at the right time. You know, just as podcasts were really starting to get out there is when I started, even though I didn't intentionally start it as a podcast. Podcast was sort of a secondary thing. So that's how that all came about.
Okay. Yeah, the landscape was probably, I mean, a lot different in 2013 than it was now because,
yeah.
I mean, I don't want to say that podcasting is oversaturated, but it's definitely on its way to being at that point.
I think the biggest problem with podcasting at the moment is all these big companies getting into it.
I was just going to say that. Every celebrity now has a podcast. And what never made sense to me about that is, and this may be a very biased opinion, but at a certain point when I was younger, I came to the realization that anything you see on TV or hear on a radio that comes out of a celebrity's mouth, it's not their actual thoughts. It's all scripted. There's no way that they're going to let these people on these public channels and give it any, like, leave it to chance if anything happens, if they say something stupid or anything like that. So when all these celebrities have podcasts, I'm trying to figure out why? Like, nothing they're saying is genuine.
Well, I think some of it is. I think it depends who it is.
There's a small amount that I feel definitely do have interesting things to say, but as a rule, I don't know, I try and steer away from anything sensationalized or big budget, because in order for it to be big budget and successful, it has to be very safe. They can't really take a lot of chances with it, and I'm that way with everything. I mean, if I get made fun of all the time because if one of the bands that I listen to, you know, if they sell out immediately, I'm like, oh man, I don't know. Like, are they doing something I'm not going to enjoy now because everybody's into it? So, but that's just me. I'm into the niche stuff. And when I see something that is niche, I can tell already that I'm going to have some interest in it just because of how small it is.
So you got someone like Joe Rogan, who you mentioned. I mean, obviously he speaks his mind for better or worse.
Right. But he made his brand on that. He was able to get in there and kind of say, like, I'm going to say whatever I say and you're going to pay me for it.
Right. And I mean, I think that's fine. I don't necessarily agree with censoring anybody.
Yeah, me neither.
It has nothing to do with whether I agree with the person or not. I don't believe in censorship. I think, you know, education is better than censorship.
Absolutely. And that's something that I've always had a hard time with, especially, like, you know, nowadays, because there's all these people who are rooting for censorship and misinformation. But everyone gets mad at me because I'm always saying, like, okay, but what about the goalposts? Like, what happens when you get labeled misinformation because you're saying something that they don't like? Once those tables are turned, there's no way to get around, you know, that then you're stuck. And you did that to yourself.
And you know, look at Wikipedia, which, I mean, it's never been exactly a bastion of truth. But, I mean, when it comes to fringe subjects, they will just kind of print whatever they want about it because they don't want to support this stuff.
Right. And that's
so you end up with a lot of misinformation, and they're, you know, claiming to be stopping misinformation by posting this stuff. And it's kind of like, no. You're not taking an unbiased, honest look at the data. You're just already decided this stuff is all nonsense. We'll just only post stuff that says it's nonsense.
Right. And one thing that drives me nuts is just the term pseudoscience, because that's such a ship sinking term. Once you get labeled as pseudoscience, then you know your whole career is shot. I mean, you can listen to Graham Hancock rail about the term pseudoscience on like any podcast he's ever been on.
Yeah. And the thing is, Graham is not a scientist. He's never claimed to be a scientist. But you have someone like Rupert Sheldrake who is and has used the scientific method, but has gotten results that other scientists don't like, the establishment scientists don't like, so he gets labeled pseudoscience. He gets ripped apart in Wikipedia. I mean, this is the propaganda control, or the pure out propaganda that they use to control people and control the viewpoint of stuff.
Exactly. I mean, it's all, you know, it's a narrative-based system. And if you're not part of the narrative, then you're going to get kicked out and you're going to get smothered as much as they possibly can.
And, absolutely.
Yeah. And absolutely. Like I have a friend of mine who it's very strange because he's really into things like psychedelics and Terrence McKenna and things like that. But he definitely goes towards the scientism aspect of things. Like it doesn't have to, you know, when I go out looking for, you know, Bigfoot or just anything in the woods, I try and use some kind of a scientific method. But because I'm going out looking for something that the mainstream scientists say doesn't exist, then it's not even worth my time to him. Like, I've tried saying to him, like, well, if you don't believe in it, what's the harm in you coming out? Well, it's a waste of time. Well, how is that a waste of time? I mean, you're still, you're going out into nature. And it could be fun whether or not you see anything, but you're never going to know if you don't at least attempt to experience it yourself.
So this is something Rupert Sheldrake posted. I saved this. We actually talked about this on a recent show that hasn't aired yet. Rupert says, in his recent book, Rationality, What It Is, Why It Seems Scarce, and Why It Matters, the psychologist Steven Pinker asserts that telepathy is impossible, and hence there is no need to consider the evidence.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense.
Exactly. And he says, this seems so irrational that in November, in a blog on Unheard, I challenged him to a debate because I think it is more scientific to consider the evidence than to ignore it. He excused himself by saying he did not have the bandwidth for a debate. But in his current BBC radio series called Think with Pinker, a recent episode entitled Being Right is summarized on the BBC website as why getting it right might mean admitting you're wrong. Professor Steven Pinker asks, is changing the way we debate the way to promote more rational thinking? In this episode, he makes a stirring call for debates in which beliefs are treated as hypotheses to be tested on the basis of evidence rather than dogmas to be defended. He is keen to expose other people's beliefs to critical thinking, but what about his own? I would still be happy to think that to think with Pinker about telepathy, following his own rules for irrational debates, if he can find the bandwidth to practice what he preaches.
Yeah, I mean, I fully agree. Did you ever hear the interview? It was a debate between, I don't remember his name, he's the head of like the Rationalist Society or something like that, and he was on Joe Rogan with Randall Carlson and Graham Hancock.
Oh, wait, maybe. It was a while ago.
Yeah, it was like probably maybe like 2 years ago, something like that. But yeah,
I know I've heard about it.
It's super infuriating because Graham Hancock and Randall Carlson are bringing up extremely well-presented, well-researched points. And at one point, he said, like, I don't care. Like, it's not as cool as rock carvings or rock paintings. And I was just listening to that. I'm like, okay, but these guys are giving you the thing that you want. You want well-researched, well-thought-out problems and hypotheses, but because it's not going in the direction that you want it to, it just is of no interest to you. How is that in any way scientific or intelligent?
It's not. It's belief-based.
Yeah, it's defending a dogma, and yeah. I don't know at what point science got to that. Like, where did this whole idea that the establishment cannot be questioned under any circumstances get so popular?
Well, it kind of took over from the church.
Yeah,
I mean, if you go back to the late 1800s, the church was still basically the authority, and science was kind of the infant, yelling in the room. And a lot of science did not want to have any discoveries that would prove the Bible right in any way.
Right.
This is why the Smithsonian wanted to get rid of the giant skeletons. This is, why we have, flood myths in every culture, but there's an ice age instead. When we might not actually be having ice ages, we might be having a shift of the axis of the earth. But these things, and that's also catastrophism. They don't like that either. Velikovsky was attacked because he used events in the Bible to support his hypothesis that Venus was a comet. And the problem is the Bible has some historical relevance to it. As much as it's been changed and as much as it can be used as a religious document, there, when they talk about a flood, that's the Epic of Gilgamesh.
Right.
It's taken from other things. A lot of this stuff probably was historical to some degree. It may be distorted, but there's always been this sort of fight between science and religion where they can't coexist. And so I think that's part of where science has kind of taken over as a religion in its own right.
Well, what annoyed me is, so, I mean, and if you've listened to the show, you know that I have my opinions on monotheism in general. But, okay, so scientists are looking for something and they see that there's a possible reference to it in the Bible. They don't like it because it's in the Bible. So go back earlier, because the Bible's not that old. And if you go back earlier, I'm sure you're going to find something that does agree with your hypothesis, and you don't have to concede to the church. I mean, that's just always been my opinion.
They don't want to acknowledge anything religious.
Yeah.
They don't want to acknowledge that ancient people were actually much smarter than we think they were.
Yeah.
And one of the examples I always use is in the late 1800s, scientists were saying that rocks don't fall from the sky. These stupid farmers don't understand that lightning is striking and just hitting magnetic rocks on the ground. You know, so even within our own culture, and you get it now with UFOs, it's like, oh, why do only these country people see UFOs and stuff like that? Like just kind of marginalizing anyone who isn't in your exact clique, basically.
Right.
Whether it be ancient people, other cultures, you know, people who are not city dwellers in some cases. And none of this has anything to do with intelligence or accuracy in the description. Obviously, meteors crashed to the earth. These farmers were reporting exactly what they saw, and they were right.
Yeah. You know, one thing that happened to me a couple months ago, actually, I was in a Norse pagan Discord group for a YouTuber that I had watched frequently, and they were basically taken to task, this one YouTuber who he's got some questionable associations, and they've vilified him for all of that, which I don't have an opinion on. I don't really know the guy or what his connections are, but they were taken into task over the idea that he believes in giants. He believes in the objectivity of giants. And so I was like, okay, wait a minute for a second. Everyone in this Discord believes that there is a god in the sky with one eye who rides around, and when he rides over your house, someone's going to die. And you believe in the objectivity of that. You believe Thor exists in reality. But the idea that giants exist, which is also part of your lore, is it's ridiculous. And so I brought up the from what actually an episode that I was watching or listening to Where'd the Road Go, about the part of the Grand Canyon that is named after a bunch of Egyptology references.
Yeah,
so I brought that up, and immediately someone went to the US government website on the topic, and because it the government page said it's a common pseudoscientific theory, I was booted from the Discord. So it's strange to me when I see people allowing one thing to exist in their mind, but something else that is equally as ridiculous as that first thing that they were totally okay with can't exist.
It's human nature to have biases, and it's very hard for most people to, it's very hard to shake some biases, period. But for some people, it's hard to shake any biases. Like it's like a safety net. They know all the answers. That's that. They're not going to change their mind unless even sometimes when they're shown incontrovertible proof, they're still going to have that sort of cognitive dissonance where they're still like, nope, what I believe is true, even though you've proved it's not.
Right. Yeah. It's.
We all do it. I mean, we all have biases. There's no way to escape it. It's part of how we function.
Oh yeah. I mean, so I was raised what my family's always called Jutheist, which is we respect the culture, we partake in the culture, but the actual religious aspects are nowhere to be found anywhere in my family's household. But I also have like genuine like Norse pagan blood. And so that is a part of my lineage that I was always fascinated with. And that's what I identify with. And so I called myself a pagan since I was like 7 years old. But as I got into magic, specifically ceremonial magic, because I was also into that by the time I was like 7 years old. And my image of the archetypal image in my head of what magic was is a guy in a robe surrounded by candles, reading off a book and summoning some kind of entity into physical form. And so I was like, okay, that to me is magic. I want to do that. So I start looking into it, and I'm looking at the grimoires, and I'm looking at the Destined of Solomon, the Lesser Key of Solomon, and the Heptameron, and things like that. And I'm like, okay, hold on. So I have to read off all the names of God. Wait, not even that. I have to believe in the Abrahamic God. Okay, so I had to like do this whole mental hurdle in my head to like get over that if I was gonna ever do traditional grimoire magic. And I've been able to get over that mostly. There's still some hesitance in my mind about it, but the way that I approach it is kind of from a chaos magic perspective, which is if it gets results, do it. You know, screw the dogma, because that's only holding you back from the results that you want.
Yep.
And so,
I think magic is something that just happens every day to everyone. We just don't consider it magic because we're not doing what we conceive of as rituals and stuff. But we still have an effect on our reality that goes beyond just random chance.
Right. Absolutely. Now, one thing I definitely wanted to ask you about is because I've listened to the show for a long time, and I always hear you talk about Kundalini, and I've done a little bit of research on that. But I'm curious, from your perspective, what is Kundalini, and what does a Kundalini awakening look like? Like, can you describe what that was like for you?
Horrible.
Okay.
That's the easiest way to describe it. So if you're practicing Kundalini yoga, it's fine. Kundalini is an energy that everyone has. It's basically asleep at the base of your spine in that chakra. I didn't believe in chakras when I started all of this stuff at all. But in learning about Kundalini, I was like, oh yeah, these chakras actually work. Okay. So that's what it is. You do Kundalini yoga. It's supposed to raise that energy through up your spine to the top of your head. As it does that, it helps you deal with issues, internal issues that you haven't dealt with. I mean, that's kind of what it does. It kind of has you face yourself as it awakens.
Okay.
For me, and for many other people I've now met, it just wakes up and it runs rampant. And our culture has no way of dealing with this. It doesn't exist in our culture. The closest you'll get is some descriptions of the Holy Ghost in Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, there's no way to handle this. There's no paradigm to put it in. So I went through years of pain of things, just, you know, hallucinations and weird stuff. Got checked out by numerous doctors, psychologists, and there was nothing they could find wrong with me. And it wasn't until I happened across a book on Kundalini in like Fate magazine or something where it listed all these symptoms of Kundalini awakening. And I went, wait a minute, I have all but one of these. I need to get a book on Kundalini. And picked up a good one right from the start. I think the first one I read was John White's compilation on Kundalini.
Because I asked you once what the best like starting route for getting into Kundalini and having your own, you know, voluntary awakening, you know, where to start with that. And I think you sent me that book, at least that or one of the other ones that you mentioned early on.
Yeah. The thing with John White is he had a collection of different chapters from different people who had sudden awakenings, people who had intentional awakenings. So it gives you a sort of broad view of it, and you don't see much on the sudden awakenings anywhere. 99% of the stuff you will find about Kundalini is controlled awakenings. So,
is that easier,
you know,
to deal with than the sudden awakening?
Oh, definitely, because you're doing it, you know what you're dealing with, and you're doing it intentionally versus, hey, this thing just happened to me and I don't know what it is.
Okay.
You know, I felt like there was something attacking me. I mean, I would have pain up and down my spine. Like I said, I would have hallucinations. I used to play trombone when I was like fifth grade or something like that, and I would see smoke coming out of the end of the trombone. And I knew it wasn't there. You know, like I was never convinced that, oh, there's smoke coming out, but I'm like, but I'm seeing it. What the hell is going on? And I would call my mom in and I'd play and it wouldn't happen. And she'd be like, there's no way smoke can come out of your trombone. And I'm like, I know, but I'm seeing it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's...
So it made me feel like I was losing my mind.
That's kind of how I felt when I had my first, like, mushroom-induced ego dissolution.
Yeah, but again, you knew what that was being caused by.
At the time, yes, on a... Yeah, so yes and no. On one hand, I knew that it was a possibility, but no one had ever described to me what it actually felt like or what it looked like. So it was basically an uncomfortable trip that progressively got more and more uncomfortable into what I would consider a bad trip. And I do find a distinction between an uncomfortable trip and a bad trip. And so one minute, I'm just kind of having basic closed-eyed visuals and that kind of dysphoric feeling. And then the next thing, I have crazy auditory hallucinations where I'm hearing this one bird way off, but super clear. And then my vision gets all weird. And then it feels like, and the only way I can describe it to people is imagine you, like all of you, is like in a movie theater, and on the screen is what your eyes would be seeing. But the first question that kind of comes up, and the thought loop that came up for me was, who's making the movie? Who's in control here? Like, who's projected? Who's behind the projector? And that was when I came to the conclusion, like, oh, okay, there's no such thing as me. There's no such thing as I. And then it was a great trip, and now Tool takes on a whole new meaning for me because I ran outside and listened to the entirety of Lateralis as soon as I came to that conclusion. And it was just really weird because I hadn't listened to that album in probably like 4 or 5 years. So there shouldn't be any reason why I remember the lyrics like I did, but I was just spouting them off as soon as he said them. Like before he even said them, I knew exactly what he was going to say. And I was like, oh my God, Maynard knows me. How does he know me? It was the single most beautiful and terrifying experience of my life. But it's what brought me into the actual decision to practice magic, because I had wanted to get into magic since I was like 7 years old, but I kept coming into these weird roadblocks where I would go to metal shows and I would see some dude with like a pentagram necklace or a Crowley shirt or something like that. And I would be like, hey, are you into the occult? Yes, I am. Okay, well, can you teach me? Like, how do you get into this? Well, if you have to ask, then you shouldn't be into it in the first place. And so I was like, okay, all right. So a few years go by, I'm in college. I'm like, huh, you know what? I should really give this a try. So in my mind, I don't know why, I didn't know that current books existed on magic at this point. We're going back to like 2012, 2013. And so I'm looking up all the old grimoires. And I'm trying to read it, and I have no idea what the hell it's saying. I cannot decipher any of this. I'm like reading Blavatsky and Eliphas Levi and Crowley, and Crowley himself his language is just impossible for someone who doesn't have any reference point for him.
Yes.
And so I have no idea what he's saying, and so I kind of gave up on it until this kind of ego dissolution happened, and I'm like, okay, so reality isn't real, so magic isn't real, but there's no reason why I shouldn't be able to do it. That was the conclusion that I kind of came to. And so, I've just been getting into that. But the Kundalini stuff really interests me because whenever you've talked about it, you've brought up the fact that there seems to be a lot of paranormal experiences that happen to you that you connect with your Kundalini awakening, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And
I think that's probably why I've had such a weird array of experiences.
And I've always been the guy that been into the paranormal since I was a kid, but never had an experience himself, and always kind of lusted for an experience. And so when you started talking about Kundalini, I'm like, okay, so if this is a way to induce the weirdness into my life, then I might as well give it a shot.
I think when people do it with Kundalini yoga and stuff, it doesn't give you the same weirdness because it's not, I mean, what I experienced was completely out of control. I would sometimes just blow up electronics. I had so many weird electronic things happen around me and still do, but I have a little better control of it now. Yeah, it was not at all pleasant in any way. Now it can be because, again, once I learned what it was, I was able to start working with it a little bit. But going, you know, if you start off doing the yoga properly and stuff, it would probably be a very different experience where you wouldn't get these random outbursts from it.
Okay.
Because, I mean, that stuff, once I learned what it was and I started, you know, focusing in on it a little bit, that's when I had the whole experience where I was given my name and everything and had a Kundalini experience where I felt like I was literally dying and I couldn't tell you why.
Okay.
Like, it just, it probably was a little bit of that ego dissolution type of thing. It just wasn't as vivid as yours. It was just a horrible, horrible feeling. And on the other side of it, I suddenly had all these revelations about all this stuff that had happened to me in the past.
Okay. All right. See, that, I mean, that's really interesting because when I went through my ego dissolution, I didn't really get a lot of, like, I've heard people say that it mimics death in the sense that at a certain point during the ego death or ego dissolution, your entire life flashes before your eyes. I didn't get that. I just got, I mean, I'm trying to think if it's, yeah, it's Parabola, the music video for, I think it's, yeah, Parabola or Parable, where the little claymation guy, he's gray, and his face keeps coming in and out of his head. Like, it keeps, like, jutting out rapidly. That's what it felt like. That was the only way I could describe it to anybody, was, like, it was like my astral body or my double body was repeatedly trying to escape my physical body and then coming in and coming out and coming in and coming out, like, rapidly. It was just, it's really difficult to explain.
The and those Tool albums, especially that one, seems to have a profound effect on some people.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've always been a Tool fan, but the, at least Lateralis, I found to be just very, very comforting through that entire experience.
I never liked that record.
Really? Okay. See, I've heard that before. I know it's not the most popular, but I've always found it to be their, not their best, but just to my own tastes, it has the equal parts heaviness, but kind of like a philosophical side to it.
Yeah. It's, I don't know, it just never did anything for me. I liked everything up to Enema, but I've heard so many people talk about that record and be like, oh, it just had this really profound effect on me. And I'm like, clearly it just doesn't connect with me that way, but that's really interesting that it connects with other people that way.
I think it's just because all of their albums are psychedelic to a degree, but I feel like that one, it captures the emotions of a psychedelic trip, good or bad, really well.
Yeah. And I've never had a psychedelic trip. So that might
really
be part of it.
Okay, that's interesting. I would not have expected you to say that.
Nope, I have never used psychedelics.
Okay.
Honestly, part of the reason is because I have so much weird stuff happening to
you
me.
You don't need them.
I've always, and I'm afraid it's going to blur the lines even more between what's more empirical and what's subjective.
Mm-hmm. I've had fears of that. In the end,
I guess everything's sort of subjective, but for the most of my life, I've always looked at it as, like, if I take psychedelics and then I have a weird experience, does it count anymore because it was brought on by the psychedelics?
Mm-hmm. No, I can understand that. Kind of like how much does the source matter or the origin matter?
Right. And I've changed my view on that a lot over the last 10 years or so. I mean, because initially I would have said, you know, no, absolutely do not ever do psychedelics because it messes with your genuine ability to do this stuff. And the genuine stuff means more. But now I'm kind of like, no, I don't think it means more. I think you're tapping into the same thing. You're just using two different tools.
Psychedelics, in my opinion, have been, if you haven't had your own set of weird stuff happen just in your regular daily life, it kind of allows you to simulate what that might feel like if you've never really experienced anything weird. Because I've had what I would consider to be like peripherally weird stuff where I've never seen anything out of the shadow of the corner of my eye, but I've just kind of heard something weird, or I've felt off, but it never continued into me experiencing something like in the flesh, in, you know, in total sober waking reality. I've never had sleep paralysis, but I have had three separate people tell me that they've had sleep paralysis where they identified the shadow person as me. They thought it was me.
Nice.
I've always wondered what that was. I've also had a couple ex-girlfriends say that there's a shadow following me. Like, I had one where in the house that I grew up in, she would never stay in my room because she said that there's some kind of shadow thing in the corner and it's always staring at her, and it's never, like, it never moves. It just stares at her constantly. I've never seen anything. I've never seen a ghost. I've heard a ghost. I've never seen a shadow person. I was listening to your last Patreon episode about the Wild Hunt, but you guys were talking about sleep paralysis, and I was like, huh, is there like a way to induce this voluntarily just so that way I can experience it? Because I'm that idiot that even if it's terrifying, I want to experience it myself just to be able to say I did.
Melatonin.
Okay. I haven't taken melatonin in years.
So Mike Hughes took way too much melatonin. I forget exactly what dose he took, and he had a really powerful experience with it. I find that because I have such a hard time getting to sleep, if I wake up, I can't get back to sleep. Like if I wake up and my blood sugar is low and I have to eat something, I'm like, okay, now I can't sleep. And I'll sometimes take quite a bit of melatonin to get back to sleep. And that's the most likely time that I will have something sleep paralysis like happen.
Okay. Okay. See, I took melatonin a lot when I was a kid, but I just took the recommended dose. I didn't, you know, try and experiment with it.
I mean, it's generally not, they were funny in the DMT, the spirit molecule book. That was one of the things they were looking at to see what kind of like effects high doses of melatonin would have. And they were talking about how they gave this guy an enormous amount of melatonin and he had called to check on him. And he says, how's he doing? He's like, oh, he's asleep. And they're like, okay, is he having any weird experiences? Like, nope, it's just sleeping. Like really, really sleeping.
Okay. Yeah. I think was that in the movie? Because I like that sounds familiar, but I've never read anything by Rick Strassman. I've been meaning to. There's a lot of books that, especially after listening to Where'd the Road Go, that I have to read, like The Invisible Gorilla. I need to get that book because you always talk about it.
We're going to do a show on it eventually. I'm going to reach out to the authors, but being, you know, and this is where that whole problem with pseudoscience comes in. I'm going to reach out to the authors who are psychologists. But I fear they're just going to say, we don't do paranormal shows. And I'm going to have to be like, it's not, no, I don't want to talk about the paranormal. I just want to talk about your book because it is relevant to how we perceive everything.
I had a guest on a few days ago. It hasn't aired yet. But they had three Bigfoot sightings in the span of 2 or 3 years. And the third encounter they had, it was a roadside crossing, and they were with their wife and two stepsons, I believe. And a few years go by, and he couldn't really talk about it, but finally he asked his family, like, do you remember that Bigfoot? And they're like, no. And he was like, what do you mean you don't remember? That was a huge monumental experience for me. Well, you don't remember that massive 10-foot-tall fuzzy thing running across the road? And they all said, no, we have no idea what you're talking about. So I've always found it interesting how what one person experiences and is super significant, another person can experience and either not find it significant at all or just never remember it and have no recollection of it whatsoever. Tim has a good story about that, about the guy who, when he was a kid, was with two other friends and they were on a path. And one of them saw a white Bigfoot, the other one saw a black one, and another one saw nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's there's always...
And with the paranormal, it seems like some people don't retain those memories for some reason. That might be because we're interacting with something that our brain really doesn't know what to do with. because it's such a rare thing for it to interact with. So it just kind of, you know, puts it off to the side and forgets about it afterwards.
One thing that I've been kind of tinkering with is, as I, you know, I've been into the paranormal for a very, very long time, but I didn't really start like investigating it for myself until 2019. So, you know, fairly recently. But the few, and I can't say Bigfoot experiences because, and thank you for this, Soraya, I didn't see one. So I can't say it was a Bigfoot experience. I can just tell you I had some weird experiences out in the woods.
Right.
But that, and then the occult stuff that I've been exploring, and then also, you know, psychedelics, there seems to be a level of consciousness raising or an elevation of consciousness that is permanent to people who experience the paranormal on a very grandiose scale, if that makes sense. Like something that, like, yeah, they see it right in front of them, or it's interacting with them in some way. It just seems to, there's a consciousness expansion that I've never really heard anyone talk about other than maybe a few people in the UFO community.
Yeah, there is, oh, what's his name? Gary Nolan? I think it's Gary Nolan. let's see, I saved a thing. Yeah, okay, so that's what it is. Yes, Dr. Gary Nolan. He has tested the brains of people who have had UFO encounters and have weird, you know, after effects from it, and showed that their brains are actually different.
Okay.
See that, and so yeah, that's really interesting to me.
Aren't there also accounts of people who, like, after a UFO abduction or any kind of UFO encounter, they seem to have, like, telepathy all of a sudden? Like, they didn't have that growing up, and so they seem to have these powers.
Poltergeist activity, telepathy, all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So,
which makes no sense if we're dealing with aliens.
Right, or Bigfoot. Why would supposedly an undiscovered primate cause the human experiencer to have some kind of supernatural ability?
Exactly. I mean, the thing is, they're not supernatural abilities. I think they're just abilities that we have weeded out as unimportant to us in our current environment.
When I was trying to talk to some skeptic friends of mine about Bigfoot, I couldn't go full on into the woo because that's where my mind immediately goes from all this. But I was trying to explain to him from a flesh and blood point of view, it's not that the paranormal itself isn't natural. It's not that it's unnatural. It's that it's unnatural to us, to our experience, but to objective reality, it very well could be a part of it. And just totally normal. But because we're so far removed from so many aspects of our objective reality, that these things that kind of filter in, they're these incredible, crazy stories. But if we had the ability to see the world as it just is, without any kind of subjective filtering into it, there'd be a lot of stuff that is around us all the time that we just can't experience.
And we wouldn't be able to function either.
Right, exactly. It would completely break us.
Yeah, our brain is a filter. It filters out anything it doesn't consider basically important to our survival.
Yeah.
I mean, you can train it to see, you know, I mean, that's what experts in things do, is that they learn to train their brain to pay attention to certain things that aren't necessarily survival-based. But, I mean, you could do that with anything, including, I'm sure, you know, telepathy and stuff like that. It's just that we don't really have the perfected technique to do that yet.
You had a guest on your show. I cannot remember what episode it was or what the guest's name was, but they said that back in the 90s, the game, like Sony, the Japanese game company, proved telepathy to be real, but they couldn't make money off it, so they just never published the results.
Oh, I vaguely remember that, but I don't remember the details.
When I heard that, I looked it up, and the only reference I could find was some on very, very fringe website. But it was basically that they had been doing these tests on how the brain manipulates objective reality around it and its environment, and how that power can be harnessed and used in a regular sense, just like, you know, to anybody, basically.
Yeah.
But once they realized that there was no way to copyright it or find some kind of...
Monetize it.
They just left it alone and didn't talk about it again. And just imagine how much potential the human race would have if money wasn't our main concern.
Yeah. And that's across the board.
And it always, you know, one thing that I'm not a fan of this whole metaverse thing. And everyone who I talk to about it, they call me a conspiracy theorist, because my belief is this: if everybody is hooked into a computer to the point where they aren't even like aware of reality anymore, they're just fully into this metaverse, well, who's going to be standing up to the companies that are destroying, you know, forests and Amazon rainforests to build, you know, satellite fields, or even just like mining, you know, all the things that destroy the earth for monetary gain? The only reason that it hasn't destroyed us already is because there's people fighting against it. If there's no one to fight it against it because they're distracted by the metaverse, then we're not going to be here in a much shorter amount of time than I think people realize.
Yeah, I've not seen a whole lot of people like the idea of the metaverse.
Yeah, I haven't either, but I feel like my concern about it is a bit more I shouldn't say forward thinking, but I'm trying to think of it as like a very big picture kind of thing. Whereas other people have said like, "Oh, I don't like Zuckerberg." Well, it's not even about Zuckerberg. Anyone could do this. Anyone could create this system to distract, and I don't want to say enslave the human race, but you know, effectively, if you're all hooked into this reality because your reality sucks, there's no one, there's no way for you to make that other reality better.
And I mean, there's plenty of sci-fi that talks to that very thing, you know.
Yeah.
And it's just, I mean, it's a more exaggerated version of what we already have, though. I mean, because our realities are so curated by whatever media we consume.
Mm-hmm.
Now, unless you make a conscious choice to not just listen to propaganda, like most people don't realize it's propaganda, but no matter what news you're listening to, you're getting some level of propaganda.
My grandparents, they're very, very smart, forward-thinking people, but they love CNN. And I keep trying to tell them, like, they're not any better than Fox. Like, I know how much you hate Fox, and I do too, but CNN is not any more of a just system of news, trust me. And they always get mad at me when I say that.
I do think that when the three major networks, Fox, MSNBC, and CNN, were studied, they did a study on them to see how much of a bias they had. CNN was the least biased.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Like MSNBC was severely biased left, and Fox was severely biased white right. So, I mean, that's not really surprising, but CNN was the most balanced. They also weren't very good, but they were at least the most balanced.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't even know that. I just from watching them, it seems like they really, really put their opinions first over any kind of objective fact.
Yeah, they definitely do. It's all propaganda at this point.
Yeah.
That's why I always joke that one of the most real things you can find on television is wrestling.
No, you're absolutely right. That or, like, ghost hunters.
Well, even that stuff is fake. I mean, wrestling is exactly... You know what wrestling is when you watch it.
Right.
It's a show that's made to look like a real contest, which is, you know, reality shows are scripted. Even, like, the paranormal shows, they're all scripted and work. The news is all propaganda. Except for maybe most, you know, big sports like football and stuff. But even them, I sometimes question how much they're worked to achieve the matchups that are going to bring about the most money.
Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely an element of, you know, heavy-handed coordination to make it as profitable as possible.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, movies and TV shows aren't real at all. I mean, there's no question there. You're watching CGI and special effects and stunt people. At least wrestlers are doing it themselves.
Yeah. No, exactly. One thing that I really like about you and your show is that you're one of the first people that I've heard talk about the Warrens in the way that you do, and kind of like explaining how they're like a propaganda machine for the church essentially.
Yeah.
And how much of the paranormal has sort of followed suit with that.
Yeah. Adam Sane did a really good job researching them too. I mean, to me, I just always disliked them.
Yeah.
I used to belong to a book club called the Science Fiction Book Club. And I got a lot of good sci-fi books out of it. And one time they had one of the Warren's books in it. And being interested in the paranormal, I mean, this was in the late 80s probably. And I was like, oh, you know, cool, a book on ghost hunting. I had no idea who the Warrens were. And I read the book and I was utterly disgusted by it. I was just like, this is garbage. And then as time went on and I looked more into them when, you know, the internet and stuff like that came up, I realized just how sketchy they were.
Yeah, I did research on them back in probably the early, like, 2000, like when, like, even before the movie started coming out, because Zach Baggins of Ghost Adventures, he works with them, or worked with them, I think, when Lorraine was still alive, but I know that he's done investigations at their museum.
Oh, okay.
And that show, now, when that show first started, I was a big fan because I'm sure it was fake, but they did a very good job of kind of convincing you. Like, they allowed you to suspend your disbelief for a while because they would, every episode they would get so much activity and it was really enjoyable to watch. And then I don't know what season it was, probably like season 5 or 6, they started to actually evaluate what they were getting. And it was just, oh no, that was nothing. Nope, sorry, that was Aaron knocking on a door. That wasn't anything. Oh, that was someone coughing. And it was like, okay, like, I appreciate the attempt at realism here, but I wasn't really into it for the realism. I wanted to see you guys freak out at getting screamed at by formless entities. But they also went into, you know, like you say, everything is demons. Everything is demons.
And Zach was constantly getting possessed.
Yes. And so what I want to, I've always wanted to have him on the show and ask him, like, okay, what if it wasn't a demon? Like, what are you going to do then? Because that's what you've built your whole brand around, is this super Abrahamic view on the paranormal.
Yeah.
And, like, what are you going to do when, oh no, it's you. You're the one who's doing it all. I would love to see his stack of cards crumble, because one of the stuff that I've been noticing as I've been getting into ceremonial magic and, like, the Goetia, for example, and one of my guests is a ceremonial magician of the Solomonic tradition for the last, like, 12 years, and a number of other Solomonic traditional magicians like Steven Skinner and Joseph Peterson and people like that, the one thing that they seem to talk about a lot is the fact that A, the spirits of the Goetia, they don't want to be here. And B, they're not very powerful. They can't read your mind. They can't really discern from, like, fact from fiction. So a lot of the times what you can do is wear a crown when you evoke, you know, a goetic demon. And you do that because they don't know that you're not King Solomon. They can't differentiate if you're just some guy or this great and powerful rabbi that evoked them 2,000 years ago. And so when you see all these ghost shows talking about these, you know, almighty powerful demons, but yet the ones that people are actually evoking into physical space, they are really powerless outside of their office. You know, if they know how to find you treasure, or bring back an ex, they can't do anything else. They're powerless outside of these very, very specific paradigms. And so it's just always funny to me when I see all these shows talking about, oh, it's all demons. Well, what demons are they talking about? Because the ones that people are actually working with, they're not nearly as powerful as you're giving them credit for.
Yeah. Well, I started out with Ghost Hunters when it was new, because, again, paranormal, I want to see it. And I enjoyed it the first few seasons until shows like Paranormal State and Ghost Adventures came along, because Ghost Hunters, a lot of times, they didn't find anything. You know, they'd do a show, they'd be like, oh, let's review the evidence. Oh, we didn't get anything. And, like, it wasn't super exciting, but okay, at least it seemed honest. But once these other shows came up and they were getting stuff every single investigation. And it was kind of like, okay, now ghost hunters have to get stuff every investigation or no one's going to bother watching them, you know?
Right. Exactly. And I think that's what plagued Finding Bigfoot was. I mean, that show, I have a lot of opinions on that show already.
I've never seen it.
Oh, you should watch it just for... If you ever just, like... One thing that I do is... One of the ways that I get inspiration for music is, like, annoyance or anger for some reason that motivates me to write new music. And so I used to turn that on just to get really pissed off at how blatantly they're misleading people and how... And my problem isn't even with shows like Finding Bigfoot or Ghost Adventures. It's the people that believe it as Bible.
Yeah.
They think that that is how you go about this stuff. And that whatever explanation Finding Bigfoot and Ghost Adventures have, that's law. And you cannot deviate from that theory or idea. And I'm glad that people like you and Josh and Tim of Strange Familiars, you guys are really bringing out the alternative theories that I think need to be brought into the paranormal and the occult and things like that. And that's what I wanted to do with this show. My entire point of making this show was as I started getting into the actual practice of magic and I started to see these... I don't want to call them parallels, but certain connections and similarities between what people were doing in the occult and what people were experiencing involuntarily with the paranormal. And so my thought was, okay, if there's a way that the occult can not necessarily explain the paranormal, because I don't really feel like that's possible. I think that we're just, it's just out of reach of our comprehension of what the other is.
But if there's
a way that people can use esoteric methods to not only kind of like repel these things if they don't want them around, but also communicate with them and find out like, okay, what are you? Like, what information do you hold? One of my friends who's he's a chaos magician, but he does it in a very left-hand path way. And the way that he came about this system that he's created was when he was a kid, he would have... sleep paralysis. And at a certain point he was like, okay, I'm not going to be afraid of it anymore. And so he would lay there and wait for it to come and purposely wait and see what it was. And then he would talk to it, talk to these shadow entities. And according to him, they showed him these other entities that could be contacted. And now he has based this entire magical system around it. And so that's right. Given me a lot of ideas about, well, okay, so instead of experiencing the paranormal where you're kind of defenseless, maybe there's a way that one could use, you know, the lesser banishing ritual of the pentagram to clear out a house or, you know, find some kind of way of communicating with this stuff and seeing what kind of knowledge there is. Cause like you were saying in your most recent episode that the clown that was dragging you out of bed once it realized that you could do something.
No, that was a sleep paralysis thing. And it was annoying me because every time I tried to get to, as soon as I laid down, this thing would drop on the bed behind me. And finally, after two or three times in a row where I'd I'd break out of the paralysis and then turn back over and try to go to sleep and I'd drop into the paralysis again. And so finally I just said, the hell with this. And I reached over and I grabbed it and I dragged it out of the bed and I was still in sleep paralysis at this point. And I'm dragging it into my other room and I turn around and it's this crazy looking clown. And it's like all flexible and you know, like the arms and legs are all wobbly and stuff. And it's laughing at me as I'm dragging it into the other room. And I stared at it and I thought to myself, I'm going to do something awful to you. And it kind of like, you know, like was like, ah, ha, ha, ha. And then, you know, I'm thinking, you kind of look like a sex toy. And suddenly its smile went away and it was like, what? And then suddenly I was out of sleep paralysis.
Yeah. See, that's such a fascinating story because, I mean, it shows that there are ways that one could kind of repel these things themselves. You know, you don't always need to call a priest.
Sure. And the thing is, like, my brain doesn't normally work that way, but for some reason it did with that. And as soon as, you know, as soon as I thought that, I was suddenly out of the paralysis. The other one was when I asked the thing that kept creeping over me, because I had a dream that I was cleaning out my parents' bedroom. And I was like, wow, it would have been cool if my dad stashed $10,000 in cash somewhere in the house. And then in the dream, all this poltergeist stuff started happening, and I was actually laughing. I thought it was hilarious, and was upset that I didn't have my phone on me or something, you know. And so I woke up, and I was like, oh, that was amusing. And I rolled over and thought to myself, oh, really, it would be cool if he left $10,000 somewhere stashed. And immediately dropped into sleep paralysis, and I felt something large drop on the bed behind me, and I went, oh, come on. And it starts leaning over me, and it felt insect-like, like a giant insect sort of creature, and it's like clicking. And I just kind of said, hey, and it stopped, and it went, and I said, did my dad leave $10,000 in cash somewhere in the house? And there was just silence for a moment. And then it said, no. And then I went, well, then what use are you? And I managed to break out of the paralysis and roll over.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So it's almost like I did something unpredictable, and it went, huh.
Yeah, because it expects you to be afraid. It expects you to, like, give it the reaction it wants, and when you don't, it's powerless.
Yeah, yeah. And even if it's coming from you, it's still throwing that whole pattern off.
Mm-hmm. That brings me to something I wanted to ask you about. So one of the, and I'm sure you know about this, the thing that a lot of traditional magicians get, like, peeved at is the argument between the spirit model and the psychological model. And my friend, who's a ceremonial magician who was on the show, he is a very big proponent of the spirit model. And I agree with him. I can absolutely believe that these are completely external, objective entities that people are working with and summoning and things like that. My feeling is, if an entity is born from the mind, from the subconscious, but when it comes into physical reality, it takes on a life of its own, like a tulpa. Does it matter at that point? Does the origin matter? I'm just curious what you think of that. Like, have you ever kind of, like, questioned that modality?
So I've never tried summoning things. That's the thing. Like, things just communicate with me.
Okay.
And I've always treated it, and even like poltergeist experiences I have, I always treat them as separate things from me because I have no control over them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I don't know if this thing exists objectively or if it only exists because of me, and I have no way to know, and I don't know that it really matters, because if it's useful and giving you useful information or doing something useful for you, it doesn't really matter if it's an external thing or something projected from you.
See, that's how I feel. Like, if you're a ceremonial magician and you have evoked something, if you demand that it give you something and it does it matter where it came from? It gave you the result you wanted. So I understand the argument, but I don't quite feel that it's as necessary as people make it out to be.
No, it's not a necessary distinction. I mean, none of this is like that. I mean, that's the problem. You know, people want to know what's real and what's not. And it's like, well, nothing's real to begin with. It's all an interpretation of reality.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all kind of connected on some level. So there's no real separation. I mean, there is, but again, that's an illusion to some degree. So where does the external begin is a really hard question.
Yeah, and it reminds me a lot of, I don't remember what episode it was of your show, but you were talking to some guys and you brought up it was like a YouTube channel or something. Someone made an experiment where they left a bunch of cameras in, I think, a haunted house, and the question was, does this stuff that happens rely on a human experiencer or not? Can it exist without us? I found that to be really, really cool thought experiment.
So, well, actually, Albert, what is his last name? He was on in the first year of the show. I tried to get him to come back on, but he wasn't interested, unfortunately. He would make robots to do ghost hunting.
Yeah, okay, that was and, it.
Yeah, and so I said to him, I said, are you getting stuff when there's nobody in the house? And he said, yes. But at the same time, those robots
were made by people.
Are sort of, huh?
They're made by people. Well,
they're made by people, and even though they weren't being controlled by people, they were literally moving around the house and like, I forget how he had them set up. But they weren't being controlled by people, but eventually people are looking at the stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if we take time out of the equation, we still have that issue of, is that somehow interacting with the people who are later looking at it?
Right. That, I mean, it's, that's one thing that I've always been curious about, especially when you take things like when people try and find Bigfoot through game cams.
Right.
They don't work, first of all. They're a great repellent. It seems like whenever someone puts them up, they get the exact opposite of what they want, which is no activity whatsoever. But what the right question is, what about the game cam is repelling what people assume is Bigfoot? Is it the things inside the camera? Is it the mechanics inside the camera? Or is it the intent behind them putting up the camera in the first place?
Right, right. That's bugging me. I'm trying to find that guy's name. but that's the thing. Intent means so much.
Yeah.
It's very hard to just ignore that as a factor.
Yeah, it is. And one thing that, I don't know if you've heard the episodes I've done with Tim on Strange Familiars. It's 296 and 298, something like that.
I don't think so. Albert Taylor. That's his name. Albert Taylor.
All right. Yeah, that rings a bell.
Yeah. Soul Traveler was his book. But that was just on, in 2014, I had him on. The Paranormal, Soul Travel, and Ghost Hunting Robots.
I need to go back and listen to that whole thing, because I remember it briefly. I don't think I ever listened to that episode. You were talking about it with some other guests, referencing that episode.
Because that was really interesting. That's why I wanted him to come back on, because he was trying to get a TV show put together with the Ghost Hunting Robots. And I had suggested that if he can't get a TV deal, at least do a YouTube channel and monetize it, you know?
Yeah, or like an internet show.
Yeah, and I don't know what happened with all that. I don't think he did anything with it. He was a NASA robotics engineer.
Okay. See, that's interesting. Like that. See, that's the kind of scientist I like. I like the scientists that will use their expertise to look at these kind of unconfirmed phenomena, regardless of what it does to their career.
And the other thing with cameras, as I've talked about a lot lately, is that if these things are not giving off the light the way we think they are, like a real, you know, a normal object would be, I shouldn't say a real object, but a normal everyday object is, cameras may not work the same way.
Right. I remember you bringing up the protesters in what was it, Taiwan?
Taiwan. Yeah.
Yeah.
So infrared light messes with cameras. And the reason that matters is because there seems to be infrared or ultraviolet associated with a lot of encounters, especially UFOs, but also monster encounters.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the archetype of the blurry Bigfoot picture.
Yeah, yeah. And if it's giving off some form of light that the camera can't process, it's going to look blurry. So in a way, Bigfoot really is blurry.
Mm-hmm, yeah. One of the, I think for Christmas this year, I got a flashlight that has a regular LED light, but then you hit it like two or three times and it goes into an infrared light. And it's supposed to be so that way you can go walking in the woods with that on, but it doesn't interfere with your night vision.
Right.
And
right.
I've been curious. I haven't used it yet. When I've been out looking for anything, but I'm curious to know if that would not elicit an experience, but allow whatever maybe in the woods, like Bigfoot or Dogman or any kind of these creatures, to feel more comfortable coming up and seeing what it is. Maybe, like, maybe it doesn't interfere with them as much as like a regular LED light would.
Well, at the same time, you have the Seattle Demon House, as Ghost Adventures, I think, called it, Keith Linder's house. When Steve Miro was investigating there, they pulled out their cameras, and you have all these EVPs. They're recording themselves unloading the equipment, and you have, like, literally, like, a full conversation going on, and there's nobody in the room except for the guy unloading the cameras.
Yeah.
And they're going, are those cameras? Yeah, I think they are, you know, and at some point, he turns on the infrared, and one of them goes, oh, we don't like that.
Yeah, I remember that. That's a, yeah, I don't know what would, it's, how would they, I wonder what that looks like to them. I wonder what it is about that that would mess with them so much.
Well, if they normally exist at an infrared frequency, then turning on an infrared light might be blinding to them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The one thing that I think I messaged you about a while ago was the team, I think it was a YouTube channel actually, and they went into a haunted house and they weren't getting any activity. And so the one guy was in the room alone and he's just talking about himself really in a deprecating manner. And then the other guys come in and they're like telling him like, you know, oh, man, you're okay. You're, you know, telling him all these super positive things. And then the EMF reader goes off.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
What are, outside of ghost hunting, what is EMF reading? Like, what, like, department uses that?
Electric.
Okay. All right.
Because EMF fields can mess with your head, mm-hmm. basically. So if you have a very strong, if your house is wired wrong and you have very strong EMF being pushed out from your wiring and stuff like that, it can make you feel bad to be in the room. It can actually cause illness and stuff.
I need to look into that in my house because we took out a light fixture in the kitchen and mm-hmm. the ground wire wasn't attached to anything. It was just flying around loose when we opened it up. And I think one of the other lights, the wiring wasn't right. This is a very old house and I don't think the code, like the building code, was up to what it is now, and so that has me having some ideas about some of the things that happen in this house and how it may relate to the electricity flowing through it.
Yeah, I mean, there are people who are very sensitive to it too, and so they're more likely to have these weird effects or illnesses from the EMF fields. So basically, that's what EMF detectors were made for. They weren't made for ghost hunting.
Right. What I've always been curious about is, like, why do they assume that the entities that people are seeing and call ghosts go by or exist within the same field of electricity or physicality that we do? Like, how do we know that they're electric in any way? How do they know that these things can be picked up by the equipment that they're using?
Well, I think just experimenting with different equipment and then getting results. But again, that holds a lot of assumptions. So if you're talking to something and suddenly you start seeing your EMF reader pop up and there's no, obvious cause for it, you have to say, oh, well, maybe something is making the EMF reader pop up and we can communicate with the one for yes, two for no type of thing. But it doesn't tell us what we're communicating with.
Right. There's no answer there. It's just kind of like it's a conversation with an entity that you don't know anything about.
And it could be you setting the EMF reader off without consciously realizing you're doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that I hope that the idea that we have more to do with the activity that we experience comes through more in the future as far as the paranormal or even the occult, because like I said, I like the spirit model, and like I believe that most of the time when people are working with these kind of entities, they are external from us, but I don't let that invalidate things like chaos magic, where it's entirely based on your subconscious. I don't feel like that invalidates that in any way.
No, no, not at all. And, you know, they're not mutually exclusive either. That's the thing.
Right.
It's very hard to prove this stuff because, I mean, it's hard to prove anything exists, really. I mean, when it comes down to it, it's proof is something we really don't have for anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, sure, if I hit you with a bat, it hurts. So you think, well, that kind of proves that that bat hurts. But, you know, like, in reality, it's all illusion.
Right, right. Like that Tool lyric from that album.
The bat was mostly free space, and so are you. Mm-hmm. It just happened the frequencies interfered with one another.
Yeah. One of the things that I forget what I was listening to, but this guy was explaining the illusion of reality, and he was using touching a tree as an example. And he was like, you know, when you touch a tree, you assume that you are feeling the texture of the tree, but in reality, all you're feeling is the response that your fingers are getting from touching that tree. So you don't know what that tree feels like. You just know what it feels like when your fingers are not activated, but when your fingers sense it, basically.
Yeah. And nothing actually ever touches anything else. That's another interesting thing. It's a very small scale, but things don't actually bump into one another.
Okay. Because the
electrons or whatever will push, the atoms will push away from one another. They don't actually like push right up against one another.
Okay. All right. No, that makes sense. I understand what you're saying now.
And I'm probably using the wrong terminology there, but that is what they have found, is you don't actually touch it, but you feel the reaction from getting very, very close to it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, and that makes sense. Especially when I'm trying to think of a good analogy. I was going to use magnets, but that doesn't really work. I mean, even though, you know, like they repel each other.
Those are just magic.
Exactly.
What was I just going to say? All right, go ahead.
I was just going to ask, I've been, you know, we're friends on Facebook, and I've been seeing you posting these videos about owls, and I'm just curious what your take on that is.
What do you mean?
You've been having, like, a bunch of owls come around, like...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the ones in the daytime, someone said they don't think they're owls. They're a different type of bird. Okay. What we do have is lots of birds of prey.
Okay.
But yeah, I've always had a lot of owls on this property. Apparently, we have a species that is fairly rare in the Northeast.
Hmm.
I think it's just a short-eared owl, but apparently they're not allowed around a lot because bird watchers will sit on the road in front of my property.
Okay.
And I was like, why do these people keep sitting in front of my property? And I went out and talked to one of them one day, and he's like, you got rare owls. they'll bolt out of some of my trees sometimes when I walk by them at night, and they'll just be like, I'm like, crap. All right. Yeah. Owl, you know?
Yeah. I love owls. They're like one of my favorite birds. When I was like just starting out with like Bigfooting and going out with this group of guys, I was in an area that has had some Bigfoot encounters. I think someone took a picture of one supposedly in 2016. I've seen the picture, and it could be a lot of things. I mean, there's no bears in Southern Maryland where this is, but there's no way to really tell, and it's a terrible picture. But we were out there one day, and we were looking for stuff, mostly like stick structures, and you know, there's a whole conversation about like why do we associate stick structures with Bigfoot? Because as far as I know, no one's ever seen one make one. No one's ever, you know, but we were looking for that. And it was one of my first excursions out with the intent purpose of looking for Bigfoot. And we kept hearing what I would describe as an owl the size of an elephant.
Ooh.
And it was weird because it would hoot. It was very deep. And then it would cough. And we all looked at each other and we're like, okay, owls don't cough as far as I know. I can't prove that, but I've never heard of one coughing. And we would follow these owl calls until we got to these big stick structures. And then the owls would go in a different direction. So
interesting.
Yeah, I actually messaged Mike Clellan shortly after that and asked him, you know, like, hey, I know you're the Owl guy. I have your books, The Messengers and Stories from the Messengers, and I love them. Can I tell you this little owl story and see what you think? I said, sure, go ahead. So I told him, and he didn't really seem that interested. I know that he's more of a UFO guy than a Bigfoot guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but the owl connection... What were you going to say?
Oh, I was going to say, it's also that he gets inundated with owl stories, yeah, too. So he may have been interested, but, you know, when you hear hundreds of them on a regular basis...
Yeah, I would love to have him on the show.
Now reach out to him. He's a good guy. He'd probably come on.
Yeah, I'll have to send him a message. But, you know, like Tim, whenever him and Chad go out, they seem to have activity that is directly after a series of owl calls.
Yep, we experienced that when I was down there after Albatwitch.
Okay, yeah, that's actually, I don't know if it was that Albatwitch, but the one, the most recent one is when I first met you in person.
Yeah, it was after that one.
Okay, cool. Because the area that Tim sometimes goes to that he calls Gazoo's Woods, that's about an hour north of me. And so I had actually been up there before I'd ever heard any of his episodes on that area. And so I had had like one very, very strange encounter and then another that was kind of strange. But I let him know. And so I met him up there, back in the end, like the last week of January. And we got a bunch of weird tapping noises surrounding us all over the woods. But I had showed him where I was planning on doing an offering spot. And so I think last Saturday, the Saturday before that, I went back up to that woods to, I actually had like a bowl and a little pendant that I was going to leave, and I was going to put it in this, what he calls a triple tree, which is like a trunk with three trees coming out of it, or a stump with three trees coming out of it. And I get up there and the tree is destroyed. And one trunk is bent in an arch and like connected onto another much thicker like oak tree, and then one trunk is completely ripped out of the tree and laying on the ground, and then the one on my like the left is completely untouched. But he left a bell, a steel bell, that, or an iron bell, I think it was an iron bell, tied to the branch of one of these trees, and that wasn't there. But I did find a shoelace tied to the tree that wasn't there when we were there.
Huh.
Yeah. So it was a very, very weird thing. And it was the only tree that was affected or touched. And there hadn't been any big storms. There was no, like, radical weather conditions that would have caused that to happen. And I can't say for sure, but I really feel like my intent, because I had vocalized it numerous times while I was with him, that, you know, I was going to be leaving these offerings to elicit some kind of reciprocal relationship. And this might be totally myself, but I don't know. It seemed like they didn't really like that idea. They weren't too keen on getting in touch with me the way that I wanted to get in touch with them. And so it kind of felt like a message. I did leave an offering on another tree nearby, and I got to go up and check that soon. But yeah, I think that intent, it has a very underlying power to all of this stuff. And I'm curious to know, when you like focus on it and you use it as like a tool, when you go out looking for this stuff, what kind of, how that changes the response. And that goes for using occult methods. I mean, if you go into an area that you know a lot of weird stuff happens, and you have the intent of like taming it or trying to get into like a mutual connection with it, I wonder if that has any relation to how it responds to you.
Yeah, it very well might. I mean, but you also have the whole lust for result thing too, right, which sometimes going out with looking for that with that intent And keeping that intent in your conscious mind, it may actually do the opposite.
Yeah. That is something that I've been very, very wary of over the last few years as I've been kind of like getting into the actual research of this, is seeing how, you know, when you have it in your mind, what does that transfigure to? What does that, you know, what does that, what part of that affects what you're trying to achieve?
I know what I was going to say earlier when we were talking about ghost hunting and stuff. A lot of people get into the whole ghost hunting thing because they want to prove life after death. You know, I mean, because if ghosts exist, then we survive death.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big part of, I think, why a lot of people are so fascinated with ghost hunting. But so when you say, well, this stuff could be coming from us, it's, I think they don't like that, because it's like, well, then we're not proving life after death. But it's like, at the same time, if we can affect the reality around us on that level, why would you assume we just stop at death?
Right. Exactly.
Because if we're not restrained by our body and we have this much control over manipulating our reality with just our consciousness, that implies we are more than just a meat puppet.
Mm-hmm. And I think that I don't know why science is so into this idea that it's all just dead matter.
It's that fight against religion. It really is.
Yeah. But there's got to be a way that they can find a happy medium where they look at the stuff that people are experiencing it and experiencing, but not immediately jump into the religious aspect of it.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
at the end of the day, all religion is a very poor attempt to interpret the paranormal, because that's just what it is. It's wrong. It's not wrong, but it can never be truly accurate, because we can't interpret it in an accurate sense.
Well, that, and then it's a very personal experience. Spirituality is very personal, and religion tries to make it the same for everybody.
Right. Yeah.
And it's like, and that's fine, because sometimes that works for people. Sometimes people aren't looking for a religious experience. They just want to feel like they're doing the right thing.
Right. Exactly. And that's a very commendable thing. And I always say, like, you know, if religion is how you be a good person, then, you know, go for it. Like, I'm not going to stop you. Yeah. I have no interest in trying to stop someone from using this one thing to make the world a better place.
And of course the problem comes when people argue about this stuff and can't see that for the most part, most people agree,
mm-hmm.
you know, as humans, we agree with a lot more stuff than we realize, but all we do is accent the disagreements. I mean, especially in religion, a lot of the different sects of religions, the variances are so small. They're like one sentence in a holy book and you have two completely different sects of that religion because they interpret that one sentence differently.
Right. I think someone once told me that all the different versions of Christianity are just disagreements on carpet color of the church.
Even when you look at the Amish and the Mennonites,
mm-hmm.
who seem they seem similar but very different, because the Amish don't use cars. They don't have computers or any of that type of stuff, and the Mennonites do all of that stuff. It's literally the difference in interpretation of one sentence in the Bible.
Yeah.
That creates that huge rift between Mennonite and Amish.
Yeah, and I mean, the same thing goes for the aspects of Judaism, you know.
Yes, yeah.
And it's so... I think that there's a part of us that, I don't want to say enjoys disagreements, but we find it more stimulating than everyone agreeing.
Well, it's also tribal, you know?
Right, exactly. I mean, the tribal aspect is really important.
Yeah. And it's hard to get away because that's so ingrained. And again, it's ingrained to our survival as well.
Yeah.
We're at a point in our culture where we could, with intent, maybe get away from that, but it's so encouraged with things like sporting events and stuff like that, that it's always us against them, you know? Like, no matter what it is, everything has to be you against somebody else.
Right. And it's always, you know, you looking at your neighbor. But if you want to have any kind of dynamic like that, the most objectively correct would be you looking up at whoever's above you. That's where, you know, wherever the power is coming from, if it doesn't have your best interest in mind, that's your enemy. And it doesn't matter what part of the political spectrum you belong to, that in itself is a division that I would like to see completely abolished. Is,
yes,
you know,
political parties.
Yeah, political parties, and I mean, it'll be a long time before we ever get there, but at least we could get two or more parties to even out the score.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I said. I like, you know, Jesse Ventura talking about that stuff.
Right.
Because it doesn't really matter what the other party. The problem is, in our culture, though, what's going to happen is you get a third party, and it doesn't matter if it's the Green Party, the Libertarian Party, whatever. They're going to be co-opted by the big corporate interests.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Maybe not the first couple of cycles, but they'll get there where they're also going to be bought.
Yeah.
And it's going to take someone with impeccable morals to be president who won't allow that to happen. And there's only a handful of those people on both sides.
And even the strongest of the moral people at some point can be bought. Like, just...
True. Well, the other thing... They'll never get into office, and if by some chance they do, they probably will be assassinated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You can look at what seem to a lot of people like two opposites who really aren't that opposite. If you take Ron Paul or Bernie Sanders, these are guys who stand by their values, who have not changed their song right up into their 70s. And possibly, yeah, they could be corrupted, because it could happen to anybody. But there's not a chance in hell they're going to get elected. It doesn't matter how popular they are or anything else, because they're not playing the game.
Yeah. And the game is the most important thing to this society. And I think that the problem is that people don't realize it. They, you know, I hate it when people say, like, oh, you know, you treat life like it's a game. Well, it is a game to a certain extent. And if you're not playing, you're not living. That's how I've always kind of tried to equate it. We're almost out of time, Soraya, but where can people find more information about you and what you do?
WhereDidTheRoadGo.com for the paranormal stuff, and TheLastExit.org if you like metal, especially metal that you're not going to hear everywhere else.
Awesome. And I do like obscure metal, trust me. So I'm definitely going to have you back on for more episodes, especially with other guests. Sure. This has been such a fantastic talk, Soraya. I want to thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, thank you. This has been very enjoyable.
Wonderful. Well, you have a great night.
You too.
Bye. And that was my conversation with Soraya Azcath of Where Did the Road Go podcast. I can't tell you how much I really enjoyed talking with him and exploring the paranormal and all these alternative theories to the unknown. And I'm very excited to have him back on for other topics, talk about his upcoming books, and to have him on with other guests. If you would like to support the show and get extra content, our Patreon is up, as I've said before. 4 tiers of support, and all of the exclusive content is on each tier. If you would also like to support the show but don't feel like paying, you can leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, and that goes a long way of supporting the show. That is all for tonight, and as always, we will see you again at the Strange Dominions. Have a fantastic night.